all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Dula-Garcia. I do not know with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. That quote is attributed to the famed physicist Albert Einstein. Today we're going to talk a little bit about what caused Mr. Einstein the heartburn and why he had such good reason to be concerned. Our guest today is a veteran who's had great success in transitioning to a civilian career after a few fits and starts. He's also an expert on the threat and effects of electromagnetic pulse, or EMTs. Very pleased to have him joining us today. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, G. Michael Hoff.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. Okay, since we're pals, can I call you Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. I prefer that, yeah. And before I go on, I just want to thank you for the opportunity of being on your great radio program. You do a great service by having this show, so thank you.
Well, I appreciate it, sir. Now, you might change your opinion before we're done today, but Jeff, the interwebs were actually still working when I woke up this morning, but that doesn't mean necessarily that the data I found is accurate, but let me take a shot. 29 books published, over a million copies sold, correct, so far?
I've got 31 books out because I have a couple books that are children's illustrated books. So in total, I've put out 31 books. But yeah, I've done, when you add up all the books that I've sold in the, it's 8 years since I first put out my first children's book, but 6 years since I started writing novels, and I've topped over a million copies sold in that time of all the books.
I would say that's a good start.
I'm very, very pleased. I definitely consider myself a man who's definitely blessed.
Well, Jeff, I'd like to talk to really two subjects today. I'd like you, because I understand you do some mentoring for other aspiring authors, so I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got on and succeeded on the path that you're on, and then we'll get into the EMP discussion, if you don't mind. Now, you are a veteran. I mentioned you spent 6 years as a Marine, kind of lost its luster. You were done with that?
Yeah, I've kind of done my thing, kind of, you know, traveled around the world, traveled to exotic lands, as they say. And when I was nearing my kind of halfway through my last year, the only kind of thing they were offering me were what they're called B billets, essentially a drill field or a recruiter. And I had been with infantry unit, or I was an O352, which is an anti-tank gunner. So for my first couple of years, I was with First Tank Battalion, and then I transitioned over to First Battalion, First Marines Weapons Company, so a line unit. And that was just kind of my home. I really, really enjoyed being part of an expeditionary force. And so when I wasn't going to be able to, if I was going to reenlist, being given that option to stay there, I just kind of decided just to get out.
Fair enough. But you hadn't lost the adventure bug, so you decided to become a commercial diver and, what, even a bodyguard. I think you spent some time doing that, guarding royals and whatnot.
Yeah, I still had that bug for adventure, it's a good way of putting it, and I went on to commercial diving school in Houston, Texas, and then went to work in the oil fields in the Gulf of Mexico, and then transitioned into their inland division at this one company I worked for. I worked for American Oilfield Divers and then went to work for American Inland Divers. Did that for a couple of years. It was incredibly dangerous, though. I was killed one time, and the pay was not very good. Contrary to what the conventional wisdom is, that it pays a lot, it does if you're what they call a saturation diver. Otherwise, it doesn't really pay all that much. And then I went from there and had an opportunity to go to work for an executive protection firm, and I did. And I did that for quite a while.
What is a saturation diver? What? Educate us here.
Well, I never did sat dive. So a saturation diver is somebody who's actually in the environment for extended periods of time. So they're typically breathing mixed gas. I mean, they're saturated in whatever that gas composition is for an extended period of time and at pressure. So So sat divers tend to work very deep down, and they have to work for extended periods of time. So instead of doing decompression dives where they have to come up and decompress and et cetera, and they also have limited bottom time, they essentially work and live at that pressure for however long the job is or however long their shift is. And those guys can make a lot of money, but that's very, very dangerous, sat diving is.
Fair enough. Thank you. Now, Jeff, in the 6 years I've been doing this program, I've found some trends, let's say, with veterans who are leaving the service. Many seem compelled to do several things after they get out. They have to have their own T-shirt, write a book, and have their own brand of coffee. You've checked all three of those boxes, but how many veterans have got their own board game?
I have a... Are you referring to the conflicted card game?
Correct.
Yeah, that is it's kind of a survival scenario game. And there was a company called Conflicted. They're out there, great company. And I met them years ago, and I approached them. I said, what about taking some of the characters from a best-selling series and using their scenarios for people to kind of help educate them? And so essentially it's a game for people to sit. They read a scenario, and then they ask in a group setting what they would do in that kind of survival situation. How would they act? And it's a really good way to just kind of sit and express what you think you should do, and everyone else can kind of constructively critique it or, you know, add anything to it or take away. While it's fun, it's also very educational.
Now, Jeff, I tell you, I love my coffee. I was raised in Latin America. I think there was coffee in my baby bottle. But what is it with you military guys and your coffee? Now, let me just say this. Your tagline, outstanding. Job apocalypse. When it's your last cup, make it a great one. Love that.
Yeah. You want to know what's funny, though, is when I was in the Corps, I didn't really drink coffee. I only started drinking coffee when I got out. It's so ironic. I just didn't really drink it that much. But I love coffee now. I'm a big coffee guy, and I always just wanted the job apocalypse is just kind of something that's fun. It's not all, and I'm definitely not competing with Black Rifle or any of these other outfits that are out there at all. It's more of just kind of this vanity fun project that I created, and you know, I make some sales on it, but I linked up the guy who roasted is also a veteran. He's up outside of Tahoe, he and I worked together for a few months and created the proprietary blend that is Job Apocalypse. Super strong, but not bitter. It's a really, really, I think, a nice tasting coffee.
Well, I'm going to get myself some. And our listeners hopefully will too. Folks, visit gmichaelhopp.com, H-O-P-F.com. When we come back, we're going to chat a little bit more with Jeff. Get some tips and share some ideas on how he's been such a successful writer and what can help you, and then we'll talk a little bit more about EMPs. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're very pleased to be joined by Marine veteran and now extremely accomplished author G. Michael Hoff. We call him Jeff because we're pals, and I'm going to buy his coffee. You can find out more, G. Michael Hoff, HOPF.com. Jeff, in doing the show prep, I looked at several interviews that you've done, and something really struck me. There was a quote when you're talking about your life really took a turn when you met your wife, and you decided to embrace, up to that point, I guess, was sort of a secret passion of yours of writing. And you said, why don't I write what I want to read? Tell us about that jump that you made.
Well, I've always been a big fan of science fiction, and specifically kind of a subset of that is what they call apocalyptic fiction. And I was always a big reader, specifically in the Marine Corps, and so I was reading this one book specifically, and I just remember just wanting something else out of it. It was a very popular book, and I was like, you know how it is, like even when you watch a movie, it's like, why aren't they doing this, or why don't they do that, you know? And I finally said, well, instead of complaining about it, why don't I write the book that I would want to read? And I'd always dabbled at writing, and I finally decided to make that happen. And what was interesting is I'd already done one book at that time, and that was a children's book. And I had done it because I was, when my girls were really, really young, I would be the one to get in bed and read to them at night. And so I then decided to create like this legacy project, and I'd written a short little story about a dog, and then I had it illustrated, and then went out. And so I've got this book that's out there, and it's really, my girls are in it, et cetera, et cetera. But so it was a combination of knowing that I could do that from an idea to have actually something in my hand. And then the concept of like, why don't I write what I want to read? And I put those two together and then decided to take action on it.
Now, you're mostly recognized for your, and I'm really struggling with this word, forgive me, post-apocalyptic fiction. You also write Western novels, but your first book, if I'm not mistaken, Jeff, was called The End?
Correct.
And that, when it comes to authors and publishing, it strikes me that thing went from 0 to 192 miles an hour at light speed. You self-published initially, correct?
Correct, yes.
And you're on Amazon. You're selling more books than Game of Thrones. But so you had to be pretty happy with that. But then finally you got a phone call from a publisher.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I was writing the manuscript. I managed to have a connection with a literary agent. She liked the book. When I finally got the book done, she wanted me to make a lot of structural changes to it. I didn't want to do it. I'd already had enough beta readers that had read it. I look at beta readers as like the actual consumer in the end. And she wanted to make changes. The beta readers loved it. I decided I didn't want to change it. We had a conflict, so I fired her. And what's interesting is in the literary world and in the writing world, one, getting an agent is tough. Two, so you typically don't fire them. I did. I terminated her. And by the way, she's a great person. There's nothing. We just had a conflict, and it just wasn't going to work out. I then turned around, took the risk, self-published it, and then for about 10 days I was like, I think I might be regretting this, and then it just took off. And I can't say what happened, really, there were enough people, and it was an organic kind of groundswell, viral kind of movement of the book happening that it just took off. I then quit my job so I saw an opportunity so I could write a sequel. And in that time, I was already getting little queries from other agents, which I didn't want at that time. I was like, why do I need you? I'm already doing good. And then small publishing houses were contacting me, and then the big one came. And it was Penguin Random House. And I was like, wow, this is serious. And so after much negotiation, I penned a four-book deal with them.
Now, Jeff, what's interesting to me is, you know, we're going to talk about technology and the threats of EMPs, but really the publishing book writing industry has undergone a significant change over the years, and you're a living example of that, you know, using Amazon and self-publishing and all these other options available out there to these aspiring writers. But I get the sense from your other interviews that if you had it to do all over again, you might have not signed that deal with the publisher.
That's correct. I was a young writer at the time, and I didn't really know. I mean, I'm a guy that I say yes a lot, even to sometimes my wife. I'm like, what? You don't know what you're doing. Why are you saying yes to doing it? And it's because I'll get excited, and I'd rather at least start something and then figure it out along the way than sit and contemplate forever. What was interesting about getting the call from Penguin Random House is that they came to me, and it really, I felt from an emotional standpoint that it validated me as a writer by having Penguin Random House as my publisher. It wasn't just some very small little vanity press or some little small, like everybody knows Penguin Random House. I felt like I had arrived, and the deal was really, financially was very good. What I didn't think I'd run into was the problem with I'm a very prolific writer, is they didn't want me to create any other content. And that became a big problem. When I was with them, I didn't write all that much. Now that I'm out, I hammer out a lot of books. And that was just how they worked was very slow. It was just a lot of things that in the end, I would probably not do it. I think I would have made from a financial standpoint, more money. I wouldn't have had the greater distribution as far as being in actual brick and mortar stores. But I don't think that those garner as many sales as people like to think they do, actually. And from a marketing perspective, too, most publishing houses don't really bring a lot of marketing power for small writers. They reserve all those resources typically for your big Stephen Kings, J.K. Rowling, all the big players, right? And so, yeah, if I had to do it all over again, knowing what I know now, I probably wouldn't have signed that deal.
Well, and I understand that as someone who produces creative content myself, it's nice once in a while I get a phone call. I'm still waiting for the phone call from the G. Michael Hoff Syndication Network who wants to we'll talk about that later off the air, but I get that. But in general, your advice, Jeff, to other aspiring writers out there is it sounds like stay true to yourself, stay true to your core and your mission.
Yeah, Amazon, people love them and hate them. I think there's pluses and minuses to anything that exists out there. Amazon, though, the big plus of it is it did revolution, like you said, it changed the world of publishing. It revolutionized it when it came out with the e-reader, and then it revolutionized it when it created a platform for anybody to take a book and put it out there. It changed the game, and I think it's a wonderful thing when things go through that kind of transition. You kind of break down the barriers that hold people back, and there's been a lot of incredible content, great books, authors being discovered that normally wouldn't have been discovered because the consumer now is the one dictating whether something succeeds versus certain people in certain places sitting behind a desk. So I like kind of that liberation of creativity. But there are some pluses, though, when it comes to being with a mainstream publisher. There are a lot of people in the world that do not consider they don't consider people a real writer or a real author, quote unquote. I'm putting quotations around that, unless you're published traditionally. It's like you don't get the respect, and it's still very much alive and well, and you can sell a quadrillion books, but if you don't have a mainstream publisher on at least one of them, you're maybe not a legitimate writer.
Well, in certain people's minds.
No, exactly. In certain people's minds. I don't believe that, but there is definitely people that think that. Because I'll go out and I'll tell people I'm a writer, and like, oh, are you published? Even when you say self-published, they don't necessarily consider that being published. I'm telling you, that's what I get back at me sometimes. I'm just saying my experience.
This is not the Gutenberg Bible. I mean, it's going to be don't get me started, because I'm one of those guys, I can't use a Kindle. I have to have it and hold it and to be able to dog mark the pages and irregardless. Let me ask you a question. Ben gets several dumb questions, but my first question for you, Jeff, is why do we so often see the phrase EMP followed by the word apocalypse? Is it because they've read your books or?
It's because if an EMP were to be used over North America, it would be apocalyptic. It would crater the infrastructure, collapse the grid, and we would be flung back to and would do so for an extended period of time. You take the grid down on a nationwide level, for an extended period of time, chaos is going to erupt. Even though government or specifically institutions, law enforcement, EMS would want to do their best, the situation would be overwhelming, even for them. And they would try their hardest and best, the police and the military. It'd be too big. And then I believe that you would start to see societal breakdown because of it. And then things would start changing rapidly. And if you look at like the word apocalyptic, people often think that means like the end of the world itself cease to exist. It's really the end of the world as you know it is really what it is, really kind of the contemporary meaning behind it. And so, yes, I believe that there was an EMP that was detonated over North America and it was effective and it did crater the grid for an extended period of time and other critical infrastructures. Yes, that would be an apocalyptic event because what comes out on the other side probably wouldn't look like what came into it.
Now, that is the subject or the scenario in which you frame a lot of your books, Jeff. What was it that, as you're going from a children's book for your daughter to writing a science fiction novel. What was it about EMPs and the apocalypse or apoc? I'm not going to try. The A word, okay?
The APOC.
Yeah, APOC, yeah.
APOC, there you go.
What was it because of your background and your particular skill set in the military, or what got you there?
No, it wasn't that at all. I mean, I had read some other books that are about it, about that, so I was familiar with it. I mean, I was familiar in the Marine Corps, you know, during our NBC training, you know, nuclear, biological, and chemical. So we were aware of what an EMP was. It wasn't until I was reading some books years later and concerning it. And then when I really started looking at it, someone mentioned it back in 2011, 2012 to me, and it's after I read a book. So I started doing a ton of research into it, and it kind of frightened me, is the best word to use, just how catastrophic it would be if one was detonated. And I then built the template off of my – used that as the means to bring about kind of this change, the event that brings about the apocalypse for the United States. The book, The End, isn't about an EMP. It's about the people's responses to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's kind of confusing. The EMP is mentioned, but it's really nothing to do with that. It's how people react to it.
Well, I tell you, because of your, I assume, like, you've done a lot of research since then, and I don't hesitate to call you an expert on this, so I want to chat about that. But I tell you, Jeff, that's a few months ago, maybe last year, I did an interview with the general who was tasked with standing up the original U.S. Cyber Command. And he mentioned during that interview that this is the one thing in his over 30 years in the military that caused him to lose sleep at night. And I feel the same way. As I'm doing my prep for this show, reading about EMPs or maybe post-EMP world, it just gave me chills. And I'd like to have you explain a little bit why to our listeners. But before we go into the next break, just give us the Reader Digest version of what an EMP is. And let's talk about a man-caused EMP. What happens? Because I understand there'd be three pulses, correct?
Yeah, correct. So there are two ways of an EMP can be created. One is natural from a coronal mass ejection from the sun. And then one is man-made, which is essentially detonating a nuclear weapon up in the atmosphere. Typically, the most optimal place for the greater effect is like 300 miles up, somewhere around low Earth orbit. And what that does is when the blast goes, it's the gamma radiation that interacts with the atmosphere, creates three distinct pulses. It's the first pulse, but specifically the third pulse is the one that is catastrophic to most systems. And it essentially what it does is just overloads a system and then fries it. So if any kind of open circuitry, anything where a surge can come down, it gets onto a line and travels to wherever it's sourced and it fries it. So if you look at telephone lines, that electrical charge would come down and then follow right along that and take it right back into the power station and the transformers and things like that and overload it. So essentially imagine this: when your system, any electrical system is overloaded, what happens to it? It tends to fry, and then shut down. And that's essentially what an EMP would do.
And we're going to talk more about the ramifications of that, because I think a lot of folks, Jeff, don't realize just how far afield those ramifications are. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with acclaimed author G. Michael Hoff. You can find out more, gmichaelhoff, HOPF.com. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined on the phone by G. Michael Hoff, a very accomplished author. Many of his books deal with the post... say it for me, Jeff.
Apocalyptic.
Thank you. I'm telling you, there's certain... Irregardless, let's move forward. You and I maybe... are part of a select group of what, maybe half a dozen people who probably read the report of the commission to assess the threat to the U.S. from EMP attacks. Why is the, and just again, something you said before, Jeff, really, you know, folks think about a bad actor or a nuclear war with one of our adversaries, but there's also the threat of just a natural phenomenon. I mean, these solar item. I mean, that what maybe 10% chance every decade. So it could have absolutely nothing to do with war and peace, but the threat is still very real.
Oh, no, absolutely. And what makes it greater is that we're so dependent upon electricity. We're you know, everything in our daily lives revolves around electricity. If you just look at the modern age, well, just look at where you're in Arizona. Arizona, Nevada, those desert states have become so populated because of electricity, because of air conditioning. The advent of this, all this technology makes it that those are habitable places more than they used to be 100 years ago. So imagine if the grid goes down, the power goes out, what happens to those places? It's one effect after the other. So you would have the main effect, the grid collapses, even with the coronal mass ejection from the sun. The coronal mass ejection is essentially a massive solar flare. And then that charged radiation comes and washes over the planet. It will, parts of it overwhelm some of the magnetic field that we have. That's kind of the buffer that protects the Earth from a lot of the solar winds. But it's still, if it's big enough, it can overpower that, generates that EMP because it's like a gamma radiation that's coming from the sun, and then creates that EMP that comes down to the ground and then fries everything.
Now, Jeff,
so imagine, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I say just, if people give it half a thought, which most of us don't, unfortunately, I get it. If it's got an electronic circuit, it's vulnerable. And we think about that. Oh, my cell phone's not going to work. Or, of course, in the movies, the cars all stop running. But people go to their faucet and turn the knob and expect water to come out. But it's not going to.
Exactly. It's cascading. All these cascading failures start to happen. So once the grid goes down, once the main power supply goes out, then you have all the cascading failures that start to follow that. And you're right. Water will cease to flow. Now, most, if you're in kind of the suburbs or you're in the city, well, if you're like in the suburbs, then you've got probably huge municipal water tanks positioned typically in the hills. And those are full, and you'll have enough water until the gravity feed stops working on that. And then you're out of water because no more water can be pumped into that because they use electricity for the pumps. Natural gas would more than likely cease to operate. And then it's just speaking of fuel in itself, like the gas stations in order to get. So you can see now where everything just all these, it's just one thing after the next, after the next, after the next. No more shipping, no more grocery stores. And now people, we live in the age where people probably only have a 7-day supply of food in their house, right? Minus a few cans of Campbell's soup and here and that or whatever. They don't have the adequate resources to survive. And therein lies the problem. People are like, well, we used to live, you know, for thousands of years without electricity. And yes, we did. But people were used to not living without it. And they had skill sets.
Right.
And they had, right?
And in days, you know, I go into high schools and I talk to young people who think that hamburger comes from the store. They don't have they don't understand that comes from an animal that was raised and fed and watered. And you make a good point, because even a typical supermarket, they've got, I don't know, 1 to 3 days of supplies for their customers, and then that's being replenished from warehouses. But guess what? The trucks aren't running. Oh, and by the way, the coolers aren't running. So, this is why this scares the heck out of me. Another example, Jeff, is, and we saw this on a small scale after the September 11th attacks, a relatively small geographic area, but the cascading effects on the financial markets and the ripples that caused throughout the rest of the country, that was just a sample of what would look like after a major EMP attack.
Absolutely. Even if you had a more of a regional EMP attack, say you had a smaller device that was detonated, say, over the eastern seaboard, just crippling the eastern seaboard would be catastrophic to the economy. It would throw us into a depression instantly. Because you're absolutely right. You look at September 11th and what happened to the markets that followed that. It was horrible. And the amount of money that was lost, right, because of there was no more trading, the trading markets were down and things like that. What if you shut down the eastern seaboard? What happens to the economy? This is not that hard to understand. Now, fortunately, though, for us, fortunately, carrying out an EMP attack man-made is a very dynamic attack. It requires two main components. One, you have to have a nuclear weapon. And two, you have to have the delivery system. Now, when you're looking at, like, the Russians have the capability to do this, you know, and China has the capability to do this, but the more of the rogue adversaries we have, like Iran and North Korea, it's very difficult. Like, we know North Korea has nuclear weapons. What they don't have is the effective delivery system to get that into low Earth orbit. But I'm telling you, they're working on it. You can talk to people in the intelligence community. That is what they're working on. This concept that we need to be worried about them peppering our cities with bombs, no, they know they need one. And it's been mentioned before. They need one perfectly placed, and if it manages to get there, could cause a lot of pain for us.
Well,
and cripple us.
Let me just suggest, because there are the Port of Long Beach, for example, Los Angeles. I don't know how much traffic goes in and out of that port. And, I mean, if I'm a true bad guy, I don't need a device to deliver this into the atmosphere. Can I just load something on a cargo ship and sail it into the Port of Los Angeles and just set it off? I mean, that wouldn't be nationwide, but still, you talk about disruption.
Well, yeah, if you're looking at just creating, you know, that wouldn't create an EMP as far as we're having some kind of a widespread, you know, grid down scenario. But what would you have? You would have a major city destroyed. And that too would cause a lot of pain. There's no doubt where our economy would be wrecked for a period of time. And having an entire region, like, say, Los Angeles, crippled like it would be for an extended period of time, what would that do to – I mean, what really would that do? So – and then would that fling us into conflict more than likely if we identified it was North Korea? Well, I don't see how we don't go to war. Mm-hmm. And if anyone's – schooled up enough on war in the Korean Peninsula, it would not be pretty at all. It would be a tough war.
Well, let's go back to Einstein's quote, though, because so much part of the reason we have the best military in the world is not only because we have the best trained soldiers, but we got lots of really cool whiz-bang equipment. But how much of that? Let's talk, you know, a major EMP attack that even takes out some of our communication satellites. How much of that stuff that we use depends on GPS and other tracking systems? And is this a case where an enemy who we consider in the Stone Age actually ends up closing that advantage gap?
Well, if it was an EMP like I have in my book, the United States military is not as hardened as it used to be during the Cold War. That's clear. We use a lot more technology today than we used during those days when we're facing down the Soviets and all their nuclear weapons. By the way, it should be noted that during First Strike Doctrine, whether it was the Soviets or us during the Cold War, part of First Strike Doctrine was the use of EMPs. So the concept is if we were striking first, so that we would launch some missiles above in the atmosphere, detonate them, have that create the EMP, hopefully kind of destroying some of their infrastructure, some of their defenses that way, and then pepper the cities with nuclear weapons. So the EMPs have been a part of U.S. doctrine for first strike during the Cold War. So we know that the conventional arm, the conventional forces are susceptible, but even more so nowadays. We're very tech savvy, very tech heavy, and it would cause some problems. Would it disable our entire military? No, I don't believe that at all. I think we're hardier than some people would give us credit for. Would it completely be catastrophic for the civilian sector? Absolutely. They're not hardened at all for something like this. So that would completely collapse.
And I couldn't agree more. And just to give our listeners an example, imagine going to your local restaurant or fast food joint or grocery store and the cash register is down. What confidence do you have that person behind the cash register is going to be able to actually make change for you, assuming you have cash? Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We come back, we'll be talking with G. Michael Hoff more about the EMP and the threats and perhaps what we should be doing to prepare for this case. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We're talking with G. Michael Hoff about EMPs and the threat of EMPs. The world after an EMP attack is a subject of many of his books. You can find out more. Visit his website, gmichaelhoff.com. Get some great coffee, get a cool board game, a T-shirt, and, of course, just some amazing books. So, Jeff, I part of what gives me the chills about this subject is this, you know, we talk about the threat from a bad actor or an attack, but there's also that big bad sun. This is not really a question of if, this is probably a question of when, but I haven't seen anybody really taking this seriously. I mean, the president issued an executive order in March, but what should we be doing as a nation with our leadership? Is there a way we can harden or protect some of our critical infrastructure, or do we just say, eh, and go on and I don't know, you know, buy lots of beans and rice and ammunition?
I think, yes, to answer bluntly, yes. It is the government. This is where the government has a responsibility. This is why we pay our taxes, and that is that they have a responsibility to protect us on this kind of a scale. And they should be working with the utilities, the private, providing grants or oversight, assistance, whatever that is, to helping the utility companies and any other people that and institutions and companies and whatnot to harden their infrastructure, to harden themselves against something like this, so that in the event something does occur, whether it's man-made or natural, that will weather it. Now, I don't think there will be a 100% coverage, but if we can limit that, if we can at least keep the grid up, that's huge. That would be huge. If the grid goes down, the grid is probably going to be down for an extended period of time. And that is the real danger right there. The grid going down, electricity service being out for weeks to months on end would be devastating.
And the societal impacts of that.
Oh, yes. I think that things would just turn ugly quickly. You know, I've gotten in debates with people about that. A lot of people say, oh, there's lots of examples of people coming together. And yes, I do think there'll be a lot of people that would kind of band together. But there also will be people that will band together to do bad things as well. Because I think what you have in that is an instance on something as large and dynamic as, say, an EMP against the nation, or even a cyber attack against the grid would be devastating. Where if it was orchestrated well enough, it could take out large segments of the grid around the nation. The problem is so big, it's so overwhelming, the government couldn't respond even if they really – they would respond, but their response would be inadequate, and therefore people would be left on their own, and then it creates a power vacuum. And somebody always tends to fill in that space, and it can be a good player or it could be a bad player.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what frustrates me when I referred back to that commission report to the commission. You know, they cited, look, if we just invest some energy and some dollars – 3 to 5 years, we could be a lot more secure. But, well, and let's just some practical stuff here, Jeff. So we talk about transportation and how that system could be down. Is there a technology? I mean, can I design a fleet of long-haul trucks that is properly shielded? And worst comes to worst, we break those babies out and start running them up and down the highways. Or is it not quite that simple?
I don't think it's as simple as that. I mean, I am always a very positive person or optimistic in the ability of humans to create and work their way out of things. I truly believe it, but we need a concentrated and focused effort on that. Do I think that we could create something? Absolutely. I don't know what the cost on that would be. And then if it's too expensive, would the average American be buying it? The problem is that I think the average American doesn't think of this as a threat. In fact, there are people actually in the halls of government that don't think this is a threat. And what's interesting, though, when you're talking about the commission report, it's actually very bipartisan. You have people on both sides of the fence that think it's a problem, and then people on both sides of the fence that don't think it's a problem. And I think the ones that don't think it's a problem because they look at how difficult it would be to pull it off. And so they don't think it's necessary to put in the expense to harden our infrastructure. And I think that that could be a problem. And I know, and I just think that they're focusing on the probability being very low. So they're kind of gambling with all of our lives.
Well, let's get a little more to the point. It doesn't have to be an EMP, right? As we speak, there's people. In fact, I think there's a gentleman who just died in California because the forest fires cut electric power. He was on oxygen, and this guy has died now. What are some of the practical things? Well, let me back up a little bit, Jeff. Ben gets his dumb question of every show, so I'm going to give you a quiz. I can go out and buy a hardened EMP-resistant structure for only $85,000. But your average person has a Faraday box in their home right now. What is that?
Your microwave?
Bingo. Yeah, it's not very complex. Now, you can put your cell phone in the microwave and don't turn it on. Safety tip there. But what other sorts of things can people, just from a practical standpoint, what should they be thinking about to prepare for this? I joked about beans and rice, but what
other... that's actually not a joke, and because we talked about it earlier, the fact that people don't have even the adequate food. What's interesting, going back to the what's happened in California and then shutting off the power, I know a lot of people are upset, and I always have this contrarian view. I was like, I'm not happy. I don't want anyone to be hurt. At all, and it's tragic what happened to that gentleman. But it does illustrate, and I hope it really illustrates to people that you can't trust the government, you can't rely on them, you can't rely on large institutions to take care of you. The ultimate person that's going to take care of you is you, and you need to have the adequate resources, you need to have the mindset, the abilities, and the skill sets in order to survive things. And it could be something as small as just what happened here. And so many people are inconvenienced, troubled. People have died now. And this is just because they turned the power off to try to be preventative from something happening. So food is definitely a component in that. People need to have an adequate supply of food. What if things went down? Do they have enough food in their pantry to last them a month, 6 months? Do they have water? Those things are absolutely critical. And then if people are on medications, mm-hmm. Make sure you have a supply of those medications. What if you can't get to the pharmacy anymore? What happens?
Yeah.
And these are very doable, actionable things that people can take. Now, I know some people may not have resources, so I always recommend to them Costco's good, but or sometimes just every time you go to the store, buy an extra pallet of canned food. Canned food, you don't have to buy the expensive, long-term storage food because that stuff's kind of expensive. But you can go and buy an extra pallet, an extra case of whatever every time. And then you slowly build up your supply of food that you've got something there for your family in case something happens.
Absolutely. And I tell you, I do rainwater harvesting just because it's a good idea. We live in the desert. But I also know that I've got 1,200 gallons of water in my backyard if I need it, gravity fed. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, invest in a good P-38. Right, Jeff?
I think something that's overlooked is, you're talking about firearms?
No. I'm talking about what we used to use back before you kids had MREs.
Oh, yes,
it's the little can opener that came in the sea rations. But anyway, Jeff, we're running out of time. Folks can learn more. Visit gmichaelhoff.com, HOPF.com. Just about a minute and a half, Jeff. What else should our listeners hear? What do you want to – any other words of encouragement to aspiring authors out there?
Well, yeah, Hemingway said a long time ago, what's the best advice you can give a writer? And I always say the same thing, and that is just write. If you've got a story, don't worry about all the other stuff. Just sit down and start writing that story. Just get it on the page. That's the best advice I can ever give a writer. And I've seen many people with just that simple advice have a book in their hand within months. So it can be done.
Well, and Jeff, I'll tell you, I have a hard and fast rule. I always read an author's book before I allow them on American Warrior Radio. I broke that rule in your case because your publicist, who I think you're married to, was so persuasive. So I am going to go out and buy a couple of your books now and read them. Do you mentor other authors or where can some of these folks go to learn more about what works for you and what hasn't?
I do. I put some videos out there, but I do. If anyone's got a question, I always encourage people just to email me. I do reply to every one of my personal emails. I made that a pledge right when I first started writing, and I make sure I always get back. I always get to people. So they can email me at Jeff, G-E-O-F-F, gmichaelhopp.com. Ask me any questions you want. Appropriate questions, please. Yes, I mentor other writers. I specifically have a warm heart toward veterans, of course. But I will give advice to anybody because I think that right now we're living in a great time to be a writer. Why not? Why, you know, put that kind of feather in your cap? If you've got a story, get it on the page.
Jeff, thank you so much for your time and for joining us here on American Warrior Radio today. Folks, you can hear more or read more at gmichaelhopp.com. This podcast and others, over 250 others, can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.